The opening minutes of this introductory course, as we're waiting for people to come in a little bit late and stuff, we could take the opportunity, if anyone has any questions from last week, or people who tried the meditation on the breath that we talked about last week, if you had any questions or concerns that came out of that, or this is a good time to have an open forum. It's particularly useful, I think, if people who are trying to do the meditation talk a little bit about what their experience is, or just so everyone can learn, and so that can respond directly to what your concerns are. Yes.
Ah,
that's a classic problem. As I think many of us know now, sleep deprivation, sleep deficiency is a really common phenomenon here in America. So a lot of people need to sleep more than they need to meditate. and maybe that's what's called for. However, aside from that, there's a number of reasons why someone might be sleepy in meditation. And I don't know if it's so useful at this point to go into some of the reasons, but some of the things you can do about it. One is you can try to bring more energy into the practice, more energy into your system as you meditate. And one way to do that is to sit more upright, to have more, even sit straighter than you normally would. And that sometimes brings enough energy sometimes to keep you awake. Bringing more mental effort to be following the breath, being with the breath, paying attention to what's happening in the present moment, that little bit of extra mental effort to be attentive and present can keep a person awake. Some people will like to open their eyes when they're sleepy and kind of look maybe down 45 degrees to the floor, kind of half open eyes. And when the eyes are open, sometimes it's a lot easier for them. For some people who are new to meditation, it's just a habit that has to be broken. The habit that the only other time we regularly close our eyes for any length of time is when we go to sleep at night. So the body kind of assumes that's what's happening. And then with time, that habit will tend to break. When I'm sleepy, I like to wash my hands and face with cold water. And that's how it stimulates things and keeps me awake a little bit more. And a fascinating thing to do with mindfulness, which we'll talk, this general idea we'll talk about today, is you take the sensations of sleepiness, you let go of the breath, and you bring your attention really carefully into the way you feel the sleepy sensations in your body. And you might feel it in your eyes or your cheeks or your shoulders or someplace you might feel some sensations of heaviness or tightness or sandiness or whatever. And you go in there and you bring a lot of careful attention to investigate what it feels like to be human, to be a human being who's sleepy. Like you discovered it for the first time. Like you're from Mars, and Martians don't sleep at all. They never met these humans who spent so much of their human life sleeping. And they want to really find out, what is this experience like? So you can really go back to Mars and really describe it to someone who's ever been sleepy in their life. And so you go really investigate, and that does a number of things. One is, it's a very powerful form of mindfulness, to really bring mindfulness to what's actually happening. And also, sometimes that investigation can wake you up. So that's. Well, I'll do it if I'm sleepy before I go to meditate, like that, rather than kind of in the middle. If I'm sleepy in the middle, then I'll just usually sit with my eyes open, sit up straighter, and that sometimes can make a difference for me. Sometimes not. It's not so useful to struggle against sleepiness in meditation. There's no need to struggle against anything. The point of mindfulness is to be really attentive to what's actually happening, not struggle against what's happening. So if you're sleepy, you don't want to struggle against it so much as you want to bring more mindfulness to it. Though little practical things like sitting up straight and opening your eyes can be helpful. Some people like to meditate in front of a bright light, like a bright window or a light, because that little bit of light coming, even with the eyes closed, somehow it's a little bit stimulating. Occasionally people get sleepy in meditation because there's something they don't want to look at. Babies have this phenomenal ability. If they get overstimulated, like if you go into a room, it's a lot of noise or something, they'll fall asleep. I think it's kind of a protection, just too much, they kind of turn off. And that ability of babies continues into adulthood for some people. If there's very powerful emotions which lay there kind of ready to show themselves, but a person not quite ready to face them, like some deep buried grief or anger or something. And so as that begins to kind of surface, some people then kind of just fall asleep as a way of not being so overstimulated. Yes, please.
I've sort of had the opposite experience where I've had a lot of anxious energy in the morning. And so it makes it particularly challenging to meditate in the morning. And, you know, my body's saying, go, 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 go to work. Get to work. And, I wondered if that would subside over time.
Probably. I think with something like that, we'll talk more about next week when we talk about emotions. But learning how to bring attention to our emotions, our anxiety, as opposed to letting the anxiety continue to drive us, lets the anxiety relax. So if you can bring your attention to what it feels like in your body to be anxious, and just hold it there without letting it trigger more anxious thoughts or anxious concerns, then it'll slowly begin to dissipate. Anxiety will only continue through time if we're continually re-engaging ourselves with it, moment by moment, minute by minute. And when we bring full mindfulness to something, it's not possible to be re-engaging ourselves. A full mindfulness is like you're taking your vital life energy, and rather than letting it kind of channel into your anxiety or your fear, you're letting it channel into alertness and wakefulness and presence. And that pulls the plug from the anxiety. And anxiety will slowly begin to relax by itself. It can be very, very valuable to learn how to meet your anxiety so that you're in charge rather than the anxiety. And since it's a common phenomenon in the morning, I think it'd be very, very helpful to include it as part of the meditation so you become free of it. So hopefully next week we'll talk more about emotions. Are there questions or concerns? Nothing, huh? You're supposed to have them.
You have a question. Maybe it's not germane to the beginner's class, but there's a big focus on the present moment, and yet the present moment to me is sort of like not where my life is really being lived, although you may argue with that, of course. It's my past I have to learn from, and my future that I have to kind of live in out there tomorrow morning. And yet there's a big focus on this second right now of my life, which to me is sort of like, should I be planning my future now, and should I be learning from my past? And I don't quite get the meaning of the present moment, but it seems to be just a matter of, you know, I don't understand what it's supposed to be teaching me. Something
supposed to be teaching me
something. To relax. That's the lesson.
That's one lesson. I think that it's important to learn from our past, and it's important at times to plan for the future or consider the future. But we need to have it in balance. And what happens to a lot of people is they can do those things really well. Some people are experts at those two, one or the other or both. But they don't have any sense of how to be alive, present, trusting in the present moment. And part of what we want to do here is have the flexibility. So we're in some sense a little bit in charge here, so that if there's a beautiful sunset or a beautiful child kind of comes in our midst and does something really nice, that we can really be awake and present for that experience and not miss it because we're thinking about the future or thinking about the past. I mean, how many people, for example, don't really taste their food that they eat? Because, like at breakfast, how many of you guys really are present for your breakfast? How many people read the newspaper or watch television or listen to the radio or kind of gobble it kind of on the run and don't just sit down and really experience your breakfast fully for what it is and enjoy it? If you did, you might find out some of your breakfasts aren't very enjoyable. So part of the function of learning how to be in the present moment is so that we can increase the repertoire flexibility of where we put our life, so that when it's appropriate, we can really be fully present. I know a lot of people for whom it's really rare. I'll say it this way. There are people I know who find it very rare that someone else is really present for them. A spouse, for example, you know, that is never really present. They're kind of there, kind of, and they never look at them or never really, they don't really get really present for them. And some of the most beautiful things we can get from life occur when we're really in the present for them. I remember when my little son was, I don't know, maybe 5 months old, I was carrying him through the downtown Palo Alto, and I was holding him in my arms. And he had this way of smiling at complete strangers as if they were, you know, the Messiah or something. You know, he's a total, you know, like the greatest person in the world, you know, he's beaming at them, you know. And I remember that he had this tremendous beam of delight looking at some guy who was walking down the street. And the guy was not present. The guy missed one of the great sights of the day for him, probably. He was probably in the future or in the past. Because we live there so much of the time. And we miss so much when we do that. In Buddhist spirituality, our future and the past belong to our unique personality, in a sense, our unique story, our drama. And in Buddhist spirituality, we're trying to connect ourselves or become aware of, like an insight into that part of our life process which isn't personal, but rather is universal. And the universal truths of who we are can only be experienced in the present moment. So the present moment is a doorway in to deep insight into the nature of our life, and nature of reality. So for Buddhism, the present moment has a lot of benefits, but it's really that the more we can stabilize ourselves to be in the present, we can actually see things much more deeply as they actually are. Our memories of the past and our constructions of the future are not very accurate. They're kind of a virtual world. As many psychologists and historians, anthropologists, and all kinds of people have pointed out, that people don't have very accurate memories of the past. And the memories of the past actually can fluctuate quite a bit. And so you never really can be sure about your memories. You know, they feel pretty true. It's my memories, after all. But there's all these ways in which there's memories always involve the reinterpretation. One of the ways that psychotherapy works is you're shown that there's a different interpretations for your memory, and same thing for the future. The future, there's no way of knowing whether the future is really going to turn out the way you're constructing it in your mind or planning it. So the past and the future is not very often very realistic. It's not really where real lived life is. And if we can start learning what it's like to be in the present moment, we can start differentiating between the interpretations and fantasies that we live in versus what's actually happening. And that is a phenomenally important part of mindfulness practice, to differentiate between our interpretations of what's happening versus what's actually happening. Also, as I said, we can learn to relax. Mindfulness, the present moment is the only place you're really going to relax in a very deep way. You can get a little bit relaxed having the most wonderful fantasies about the future or wonderful reconstructions of the past. But you can only go that far. You can only go actually very limited direction. If you really want to relax your whole body and mind and heart in a very deep, deep way, it's only possible to do that if you're willing and contented to be in the present moment. If most people, if you're quite honest about yourself, and you investigate why you spend a lot of time thinking about the future or a lot of time thinking about the past, you probably find that there's a lack of trust and contentment in the present. And what we're trying to, in spiritual life, we're trying to find a very deep trust and contentment in our life and ourselves as we are lived right now. So that's some of the reasons why we want to be present. Yes?
What you had just said, I found to be very true. That the meditation is not particularly pleasant for me. And having spent many years doing transcendental meditation, it's a very much more pleasant experience for me. And so right now I'm doing both. But a lot of time the mindfulness meditation is not nearly as perceived for me right now to be as pleasant, because a lot of times when I'm present, there's emotions that I particularly don't want to see or feelings that I particularly don't want to feel that come up.
Right. And that's a common experience for people who do concentration practices or those kinds of practices. It can actually be a little bit difficult to do mindfulness, because mindfulness is much more like facing ourselves as we actually are. But then by doing that, we have a chance to work those things out. Not by analyzing them, but through this non-discursive mindfulness, for example, and then seeing to the other side of them, and by coming to terms with them. So the classic example I like to give is, if you do a concentration practice, you can get very calm, but then you can go out in 101 at 5 o'clock and get really, you know, irritated. Because you haven't really learned anything about how your irritation is born and what triggers it and how you can respond to it and be present for it in a useful way. But in mindfulness practice, you're learning how to really see your irritation and really understand the root of it, so that you can really pull out the root, so that in the future you can go in that 101 at 5 o'clock and not be irritated. But you can only do that by actually, you know, we enter into where life is actually lived. Yes?
I've actually found recently sort of the opposite, which is that I find myself mindful of activities that I wasn't mindful of before outside of my practice. And it's such a new experience that it's almost disconcerting. It's like, when does this, is this the state that I'm trying to be in, mindful all the time? Maybe it's just uncomfortable because it's so new.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering if you could address that. Once mindfulness infiltrates the rest of your life, if there's sort of getting used to that aspect of it as well.
Sure. Sure. I mean, there's a lot of challenges to being present for your life as it's lived. Many people find it's better to escape a little bit. And so there's many challenges. Also just awkwardness. It's like a new orientation. To be fully present and sensitive to the world. Some people find for a while that they feel too sensitive to what's going on in their life. And now they're really sensitive to the degree of suffering that's around them. They had no idea these people at work were suffering so much, or around them were suffering so much. And because now they're really paying attention. There's a lot of things that can involve a shift, and it can be kind of a little rocky for a little while. But one of the things that made me really happy, a particular moment in my mindfulness practice was, I don't know if this will make sense to many of you, especially those of you who are new, but when I realized that whatever I was experiencing, no matter what I was experiencing, I had the capacity of bringing attention to it, mindfulness to it. And that made me really happy, because I knew that the possibility existed for me to be free in the midst of whatever was happening to me. Because mindfulness and freedom are closely connected. And if you can learn to be really mindfully present for your life as it's lived, you'll find the possibility of freedom. Yes?
At the risk of sounding like the beginner that I am, I just felt, when I was trying to get quiet inside, I had all these thoughts ricocheting, you know, just anything. Am I going to make it on time to kindergarten with my daughter tomorrow? Did I pay my bills? I mean, am I trying to put all those things aside and just focus on one thing? Am I just trying to have kind of blank? I guess I don't know what I'm supposed to be thinking.
No. There's nothing you're supposed to be thinking about, nothing you need to be thinking about when you meditate, but you don't need to stop your thinking either. What you want to do is and not be interested in it, your thinking. Not participate in your thinking. So what you participate most fully is, right, for what we're talking about now, is just your breathing. And just let this vital attention that we have flow into your breathing, as opposed to flowing into more thinking. So in the background, there might be all kinds of thoughts.
Right.
But you just let them be in the background. Don't worry about them if they can stay in the background. And if they come in the foreground, then gently let go of them and come back to the breath. And keep the breath in the foreground. And we'll talk this more. I'll answer more of this as I talk about give the instruction today. So last one, yes.
Well, what about tricks like breath counting?
Some people find it useful to count their breath. It stabilizes the mind. It helps the mind concentrate and enter the present moment. Generally, we consider that to be more of a concentration practice, which is kind of stabilization practice. If the mind is really wild, and it just seems really hard to kind of settle down into the present and be present for the breath, then counting the breath can be very useful. And the usual way is to count each exhalation, 1 to 10, and then start over again. And if you lose count, don't worry, just start again at 1. It doesn't matter if all you ever get to is 1. Just start over again. But it's not it's not mindfulness practice. When we do mindfulness practice, we're trying to be mindful of what's going on, not worrying about so much about how concentrated we're getting. But we're just not using any tricks, say that way. So rather than relying on tricks, we're just simply relying on whatever natural ability we have to be mindful, and then strengthening that ability through time. And so it can be kind of rough in the beginning because the mind wants to go off. But slowly we learn how to do it on our own without the help of some aid like that. Okay, so in a couple of minutes, I'd like us to do a first sitting. And a couple of words before that is... kind of continuing what we've talked about already. When we live in our thoughts, most people take up residence in their thoughts. That's where they live, is in their thoughts. And many of our thoughts are, when we live in our thoughts, we live in a world of aboutness. You know, if you talk with someone about what happened yesterday, you're talking about something. It's very different from what actually happened. It's an aboutness. If you're talking about something that might happen tomorrow, it's about what might happen tomorrow. If you're telling someone some interpretation of what's going on, it's a world of aboutness. It's not really what's going on. If you have a itch on your knee, and you start telling your story, what that it's about? Oh, that must mean, I'm sure that's skin cancer. I was always worried about I was going to get, and you know. And suddenly we're living in the world of aboutness, what it's about, rather than just in and of itself. The world of aboutness is the world of our thoughts and ideas. And our world of our thoughts are wonderful, but the world of our thoughts keeps us somewhat separated also, can keep us separated from our lived life. Our about life is very different from our lived life. And it's very important to know the distinctions for that for the purposes of meditation. To be sensitive of when we've moved into our commentary about things, the stories about things, interpretations about things, our thoughts judging what's going on, evaluating what's going on. Oh, you know, you sit down, you close your eyes, you get yourself composed, and you watch 2 or 3 breaths, and then you say, how's it going? Am I doing as well as the person next to me? Or, you know, is this the right kind of breath? Or, you know, oh, this is really, I'm doing really well now. You know, we go into our thoughts, and we start living about what's going on, as opposed to living in the actual experience. So to be able to see the difference between this is very important, because what we want to choose in meditation is to let go of any kind of aboutness, thoughts or commentary about the experience, and choose to enter into the lived experience, how we're actually experiencing it very directly and immediately. So the breath, for example, there's a living, immediate experience of breathing in and breathing out, the expansion and contraction of the torso as you breathe. And then there's all the thoughts we have about the breath. Oh, I'm not having the right breath. I wish I had a long and deep breath. After all, I live in California. That's the whole point here, isn't it? And it's, you know, and my breath is shallow. And so we enter all these thoughts and ideas about our breathing, which are not the same thing as feeling it. For the purposes of meditation, it doesn't matter what kind of breath you have. It just matters that you bring your attention into the breath and feel it as it is. So as we do the meditation, have a gentle attentiveness to how we slip into the world of aboutness. It's a virtual world, a virtual reality of sorts, the original virtual reality, which really doesn't keep us very connected to life as it's actually being lived. So take a meditation posture. Sitting upright, alert in your spine. Then feeling how the pressure and movement comes from the inside of the body. Take a deep breath. And then as you exhale, relax the body. Using a deep in-breath to connect to your body, and a full exhalation to let go of your thoughts and concerns, let go of the surface tension of your body. And then return to a natural breath. Let your breath breathe itself in whatever way it wants. And then in the beginning of meditation, it's often good to relax some of the obvious tensions in the body. Sometimes you can soften your forehead. Perhaps the jaws. Perhaps as you breathe out, you can relax your shoulders. Perhaps as you breathe out, you can relax your belly. And then in the most general way you can, become aware of your body. Just allow yourself, let the body be whatever way it is, and feel it. Feel how your body feels right now. Letting go of any commentary about the body. Just let it be as it is and just feel it. whatever full sense you have of being in a body. And then within your body, as part of your body, become aware of the body's experience of breathing. Noticing where you feel the breath most clearly. Perhaps you feel it as the abdomen rises and falls, or the expansion and contraction of your chest. Perhaps the feeling of air passing in and out through the tip of your nostrils. And wherever you feel it most clearly, let that be the place where you center your attention on the breathing. If your thoughts are in the background and you can primarily keep the breath in the foreground of your attention, just let the thoughts be in the background. Don't worry about them. But when your mind wanders off and gets lost in its thoughts and you notice it, then gently relax and come back to your breathing, placing the breath again in the foreground of your attention. And one of the aids which is used in mindfulness practice to help us stay with the breathing is to very quietly, as quiet whisper in your mind, label each in-breath and out-breath. You can label it as in for in-breath and out for out-breath. Or some people do rising for the rising of the abdomen and chest, and falling as it falls for the exhalation. A very, very gentle and soft naming of the experience in the mind to help you stay present for it. It's kind of like using a thought to keep you connected rather than letting your thoughts kind of idly think about whatever they want. Let go of your thoughts. Come back to your lived experience of breathing. Letting yourself go into your breathing, relaxing into your breath. Whatever is happening for you that makes it difficult to be with the breathing, just acknowledge it and let it be in the background. There's no need to set up a conflict between the breath and that other experience. Just let it be in the background. And place yourself, center yourself with the breath in the foreground. Letting the experience of breathing in and breathing out calm you, calm the body and mind. And then now, let go of paying attention to the breathing and look through your body and find whatever physical sensation your body is the strongest. It doesn't have to be that strong, but whatever happens to be the strongest sensation in your body. And then bring your attention there so you can simply feel it. Know it for what it is, giving it full permission to be there the way it is. Allowing your sensation to be there, but feeling it, sensing it. Seeing if you can let go of any of the commentary about the sensation in favor of just feeling it more fully, resting in it. Noticing what happens to the sensation as you bring yourself to feel it more closely. If the sensation disappears, then find the next strongest sensation in your body somewhere else. If the sensation stays or gets stronger, continue to hang out with it. Noticing the difference between your attitude towards the sensation and the actual sensation itself. And if you can see the difference, rest yourself in the actual experience. And as a way of encouraging yourself to stay present for the sensation in your body, very softly, gently in your mind, And then come back again to the breath. And then for one last minute, surrender everything you have to just feeling the breath fully and completely. So it's perhaps unfortunate that when we translated the Buddhist word sati into English, we chose the word English word mindfulness, since it puts a stress on the word mind. Sometimes I wish we translated it as bodyfulness. And the reason for that is that our embodied experience is really a very important foundation for mindfulness practice. To really be in our body, feel our body, experience our life through our body. Which for some people is almost a foreign idea. I think it's easy enough to find people here in Silicon Valley area who live so much in their head all the time, in their thoughts, that it's basically who they are, who they think they are. It's just this little kind of person up here. We're just kind of negotiating in a lot of thoughts and ideas and concepts and pushing them around. And the body is just this kind of awkward tool that kind of carries around this little, you know, body, this little person up there in the head that does all the thinking, a really important center stage. It's a very limited sense of life, a very limited sense of who we are as a human being, to identify so strongly with our thinking. To create the kind of foundation of presence, the foundation of being present for ourselves, that allows for some deep spiritual work, some deep relaxation and trust to arise. It's very important to experience ourselves more fully, including our physical sense of who we are, our embodied sense. It's almost like the mountain or triangle. Not to make a hierarchy of what's higher than something else, but it's kind of like we're kind of like a triangle, and our physical embodied sense of being is really the foundation that supports, that stabilizes the triangle. And a very small part of who we are, you know, is our thinking at the top of the triangle. And most of us, we have the triangle inverted. And so it's very hard to live a balanced life when you're kind of upside down with it all, trying to support it all on the tip. The body is very important. And developing some better sense of being in our body. Some people find themselves that they have no connection to their body below their neck. They just don't know what goes on there. Some people, it's not that they don't feel anything below their waist. Various people are disconnected to parts of their body. As we do mindfulness, the body becomes awakened. It is not just simply a mental awakening that happens in Buddhist practice, but it's also a physical awakening of the body, of our senses all around. So in the meditation practice, we include mindfulness of the body as part of the practice. And it's done this way. I think it's useful to think of foreground and background of attention. If when we first sit down to meditate, we place the breath in the foreground of attention. In the background, there might be many things: bodily sensations, sounds, feelings, thoughts. Many different things might be there in the background. As long as they stay in the background, there's no need for us to get engaged with them. And you can just stay with the breathing. But at some point, what's in the background comes into the foreground. Either it might even replace the breath as a foreground thing. When something in the background comes into the foreground, or something else comes in the foreground besides the breath, and is more compelling than the breath, the instructions is to forget about the breath, let go of the breath, and simply bring that meditative attention to that thing which has come into the foreground. So today we're talking about our physical experiences, the senses and experiences in our senses. If one of the experiences in our five senses becomes more predominant, more compelling than how it is to be with the breathing, then we let go of the breath and we bring our meditative attention to that experience at the sense door. If it's a physical sensation in the body, then we bring our full attention as best we can to rest in that experience and get to know it, investigate it, to rest in it, to learn what it's like to be unreactive with it, to learn the difference between our attitude towards the sensation and the actual experience itself. To feel it, sense it from the inside of the body. Many of us will feel a sensation, but again, we live in the aboutness about it. The meaning of it, the interpretation of it, the description of it in our mind, as opposed to the way we actually feel it and sense it. It's very fascinating to actually feel sensations directly, as opposed to experiencing parts of our body through our concepts and ideas and our memory. If you take your hand, you can either close your eyes or you can put your hand behind your back. So you don't see the hand. And then just feel the hand. What does a hand feel like when you don't look at it? Do you have a sense of where the arm begins, where the arm ends and the hand begins? What are the sensations of the hand as you feel it there directly? Tingling, pressure, warmth, coolness, tightness, looseness. In the world of our direct experience, in a sense, there is no hand as a concept. What there actually is in the moment are those sensations you feel, the immediate felt sense sensations. We use our concepts to construct the idea of a hand. And many of us live in the memory and the idea, oh, this is my hand, which is certainly a valid idea, but that's different from the actual experience of it. The felt sense experience, which actually is not conceptual at all, just sensations that has, in a sense, no boundaries. That make sense at all, what I said? And try another little experiment. Let me close your eyes and put a finger on one of your thighs. And then slowly, feeling how the sensations change, increase the pressure against your thigh, pushing your finger in, until you're pressing somewhat hard, and then hold it. And feel the sensations, maybe a little bit of pain, some pressure, some hardness, some tautness, some tension, some vibration, some heat. And then feeling how the sensations change, slowly release most of the pressure, but not all of it. Just leave a little bit, and then hold. Then just feel the sensations of a light pressure. Now in the world of your direct experience, there is no thigh, there is no finger. There are only those particular sensations floating in a sea of space. Of course you have a thigh and a finger, but it's not what we experience in our immediate felt sense experience when we only feel just very simple, very direct sensations. So the idea is to, when there's some strong physical sensation in the body, to bring ourselves and just feel it, what it's like very directly and immediately in its simplicity of this experience. And then it can be helpful to label the experience, to use a mental note. As long as it's there, just kind of name it very gently, softly, in a kind of ongoing way. If it's an itch, just itch, itch, itch. The name is not so important. It's kind of like gently encouraging the mind to stay present for the experience. It's kind of like making a frame around the experience and say, oh, here's where I bring my attention to feel this itch right here. If you feel a pain in your knee, just kind of bring your attention to that pain, just feel it there in and of itself. Discomfort is often a very interesting place to bring mindfulness for many reasons. One of them is that a lot of people in our culture have a strong prejudice against discomfort. They'll do almost anything to avoid the discomfort. Go for the aspirin, go for whatever relief they can find. And rather than feeling it directly for what it is in its simplicity. And in mindfulness meditation, we don't want to reach for the aspirin or for the cure too quickly. We just want to be able to feel it as it is. And what's interesting with physical discomfort, like a knee pain, is you learn a lot of, you get a lot of insight from learning to bring simple mindfulness to the knee pain. One of the great insights that sooner or later will dawn on you is the phenomenal difference between a physical pain and the relationship you're forming with the pain. Your aversion to the pain, your impatience with the pain, your discouragement with the pain, your despairing with the pain, your, you know, all your attitudes towards it, all your relationship, we form a relationship to the pain. And for most of us, we get the relationship and the experience entangled. We don't see them as being two different things. But they're actually very different from each other. And it's possible to have a tremendous amount of physical pain and have the heart and mind completely equanimous. No relationship of aversion or impatience is entered into the equation. Even just to see that the two are different can make it much more easy to stay with physical pain. Because it's kind of like a gap then between it. We don't take it quite as seriously when we see that our aversion to it is different than the actual experience. The experience itself is fine, just as it is. It's amazing to say that. I mean, if you haven't had that experience, you don't believe me. How can I say that about pain? I've had a tremendous amount of pain, and you know, mine is completely at peace. Pain doesn't automatically mean that you have to be agitated. And one of the values of learning to hang out with discomfort in meditation is you learn a strength of mind, a strength of heart that learns how to be at peace, how to be without agitation in situations which are challenging, which are uncomfortable. And that is really, really helpful. And the idea is to bring our attention carefully into the sensation. And to really feel it like you never felt it before. Like if it can be both great, very pleasant sensations or very uncomfortable ones, but we often keep ourselves a little bit distant from our sensations. We experience it kind of from a distance, almost as an abstraction. And pain, that's one of the other things that's fascinating with pain, is pain is just an abstraction. The word is an abstraction. If you really feel the pain carefully, you'll find it's made up of some very particular sensations. It's made up of pulling, of tightening, of stabbing, of searing, of twisting, of tearing, of, you know, pricking, of, you know, a lot of different particular sensations. And it's a very different to experience the particulars of sensations than it is to experience the abstraction. And what we're trying to do is drop out of the abstraction, just feel it directly for what it is. The idea is, if there's loud sounds, if sounds come into the foreground and it becomes hard to stay with the breathing because of it, let go of the breath. And then just do listening meditation. Have a meditative awareness of sounds. Just maybe quietly remind yourself of listening. But just do listening, listening, or hearing, hearing. And just as long as the sounds are predominant, just do listening meditation. For however long it's there. It can be the whole period of meditation if the sound is there for a long time. Some people who meditate will feel that sounds like from a neighbor's house or something are a distraction. They're getting in the way of my meditation and my peace. And if only those sounds weren't there, then I could really kind of get into this. And we have this resistance and irritation attitude towards it. There are no distractions in mindfulness, just something else to pay attention to. So we can develop the same meditative awareness and presence for whatever is occurring. And if sounds are occurring, then we bring our attention to that. My teacher in Burma, he was kind of a self-righteous, strong, kind of warrior type of meditator. And when he went to the monastery first to meditate, he would stay up late in the evening, sitting in his bed, meditating, get up early in the morning to meditate. And he had a roommate who he considered to be a lazy, no good, who would go to bed early and sleep late. So that was one thing, but as my teacher was sitting there, as a young student, kind of meditating, the roommate would snore. And the first couple of nights, he was really irritated. He's disturbing my meditation. And then finally, he gave in. So, this is terrible to have this resistance. So I'll just take his snoring as being the focus of my meditative attention. And he was able to get very, very concentrated, very still and quiet with that sound. And the senses, we're developing this meditative awareness that can be kind of spacious and open, relaxed about anything that's occurring. It's not sending up resistance or struggles against anything, but just is fully present for things as they are. And so as things as they are shows itself in the body, then we want to just allow that to happen and let it come into our awareness. Let it replace the breath as it becomes stronger and it kind of becomes more compelling than the breathing. And there can be a wonderful sense sometimes of this dance or this flow of different sensations. We stay with the breath and then some strong sensation arises somewhere. Maybe some wonderful, delightful pleasure arises somehow in the chest. And so it's much more compelling. It's more pronounced in the breath. And we just let it, that becomes the primary focus for a while, just feeling the pleasure, the pressure that might be there. And then that dissipates and you go back to the breathing for a while. And then some very strong pain arises in the lower back or something. And you go and you feel that in the back for a while. And then comes your thoughts about it. Oh my God. And then you notice, I'm thinking about it rather than feeling it. And you go back and just feel it and sense it. And then it dissipates after a while and you go back to the breath. Or maybe some other strong sensation has replaced it. So there's a sense of kind of the mind, the body, the heart can kind of relax, allowing whatever comes up, whatever is most powerful, whatever is the primary thing happening in the moment, just letting it come and bringing our full quiet attention to it, our meditative attention to what's happening now. So that makes sense? Yes?
Why does it dissipate? You said it dissipates.
Oh, why does it?
I actually experienced that.
The,
I have a stiff neck when you said experienced that. I concentrated on that. And then we were saying, now concentrate something else, on something else. And I noticed that was gone. It wasn't there. Why did it happen physically?
Could everybody hear her question? So she said she felt a very strong tension, I guess, and pain in her back shoulder area. And she brought her attention to it in the way we instructed in the meditation, and it dissipated, went away. And she was wondering, why did it go away? What's the mechanism? There's a number of things that could be said. I tend to always have a lot of reasons rather than some one simple one. I apologize, but life is not so simple, right? One is that everything is impermanent. And the permanence that we often experience in our experience, kind of how we feel things and how we sense things and how our emotions and all that, comes not in the nature of, the permanence is not in the nature of the emotion or the physical sensation, but rather in the holding, that we, of holding it there. Especially like tension in the body. And the holding is something you're constantly redoing. And if we stop holding onto it, holding onto the emotion, holding onto the tension in the body, the natural thing it wants to do is to relax and release itself. And when we bring very careful mindfulness to it, allowing it to be there, not reacting to it, then we're not holding onto it. And the tension can begin to relax. It's kind of like if you bring very careful attention to something, it's kind of like you're giving it lots of room so they can kind of relax onto all the space you made. And when you're very tense about something, there's no room in there for it to relax. So mindfulness is like making lots of room in your mind, your body, for your experience. Another reason why physical tension and pain can disappear in meditation is not because the tension goes away, because sometimes the concentration can be so sharp, like a laser, that we drop into a deeper level of that experience than the surface level. And the deeper level has no pain as part of it. It's kind of like, I don't know if this is a good analogy, but it's kind of like this is what occurs to me. You know, we feel the solidness of this floor, and it feels pretty solid to us, and that's how our experience is. This is the way it is. But if you can bring kind of a laser, microscopic focus onto that floor, you know, really kind of a very, very strong microscope, you'll see that mostly the floor is made up of a lot of space. You know, it's actually very, very, very little matter underneath us. I mean, it's phenomenal little, right? You know of that from physics, right? And it's just amazing. You know, you can get scared. You know, like, what's holding me up? You know, it's 99.99% space underneath me. And so the solidness of that floor disappears as you kind of look really closely to it. So sometimes the concentration in meditation is that strong that we drop down to another level of the experience. And so some of the surface levels aren't so present. And so if there's pain, for example, it disappears for that reason. Does that make some sense? Yes?
Is that the same sort of reason sometimes when I'm meditating, I basically sort of lose track of my whole entire body? And so I'll be concentrating on the breath or whatever, and everything else just seems to disappear. Is that the same reasoning?
It can be. It's a function of concentration where the sense of body disappears. And it can disappear in different ways. One way is that the concept of body disappears, just like when the concept of hand disappears. Most of us orient ourselves towards our body and our environment through our concepts of who we are, concepts of body and space and body and time and all that. And it takes a certain amount of effort for the mind to construct concepts and keep them there. And as the mind gets quieter and quieter, the normal concepts of self-image, for example, that we have, begin quieting down. And so the self-image that holds it all together as a kind of coherent picture of who we are falls away, and there's no sense of kind of being in a body, just all these sensations happening. At a different level, all the sensations disappear too. And your eyes are closed, and for all practical, not practical purposes, but for all experiential purposes, you simply cannot find that you have a body. You know you have one, you know. It's not like you've become invisible, but the experiential sense is that everything's gotten so peaceful and still that there's no sense of being in a body.
It's kind of scary for me when that happens.
Yeah. It's a very common for people to get afraid when that happens, partly because they're so used to, they get a certain level of security in life by having a self-image in which they orient themselves to the world. All kinds of self-images. You know, this is who I am. I'm this kind of person. It's a whole range of them. And we want people to see us that way, and because we know people see us basically this way, then we know how we're supposed to relate to them. But if our self-image drops away, because there's so much trust and relaxation in life, then for a while it can be disorienting. But eventually we learn how to relax and it becomes fine. The analogy here that's used is it's kind of like being thrown, if you don't know how to swim, and you're thrown into a pool, and at first you trash about thinking I'm going to drown. And then all you need to do, finally you learn, all you have to do is relax, and the water will hold you up. So the same thing with meditation is that it's fine not to have a self-image. All you have to do is relax and you'll be held up beautifully. Yes?
Sometimes when you're beginning to meditate, it can arouse strong reactions in other people. A couple of years back, my brother started meditating. My mom reacted, saying, "You're just so selfish. Why don't you do something practical and useful, like mowing the grass, or raking the leaves, or helping out? Don't just sit there and be so selfish." How do you respond to that sort of plea that it's basically selfish to be meditating?
How do you respond? I'm not sure how I'd respond. It's a very interesting phenomenon. It's quite common for people to do that. I mean, someone could do stamp collecting, or spend an equal amount of time watching television, and people don't have the same judgment. But somehow, something about meditation, because that's selfish. So just pointing out that why are you calling this selfish? But when I spend 45 minutes meditating, but I spend 2 hours in the evening watching television. Why don't you say that's selfish? And see how they respond. That would be interesting. Yeah, that's certainly. There's something about meditation which threatens people somehow, or puts it's a kind of a category of a phenomena where people associate it with that it's kind of like it's a religious thing, experience perhaps, and so religion should always be socially engaged, and so there's a kind of expectation. That it's supposed to be a certain religion is supposed to be a certain way. It's supposed to be altruistic. I don't know. It's very interesting, this phenomena, that people assume that meditators are being selfish. One of the ways to respond is to say, yes, there is a certain focus on self here. But what I'm doing is relaxing my selfishness. This is the only way I know how. So when I come out of meditation, I can be much more present and helpful to others. But if I try to be helpful to people while I'm still selfish, it's going to be, you know, it's just going to cause a lot of stress for everyone. So it actually makes me much more sensitive and present in order to be helpful in the world. It also regenerates me. The social activists often find it's very helpful to spend periods of time meditating because some of the tensions and stresses that get built up get dissipated, and then they can go back into their social work regenerated from it. Yes.
Sometimes, if you stick with it, and the family member who feels this way sees for himself that it works, and the value of it, it may take a while.
This is one of the beautiful things. If you don't proselytize to your family members, and just merrily kind of continue quietly on your own. And then by osmosis, they pick something up, you know, and what's going on here? And it's, you know, it might take some years or decades or who knows how long, but you know, sometimes the spouse will never start meditating, but they have this great appreciation for it. Wow, you know, I think you need to meditate now. Or, you know, I really like it when you come back from those retreats. they feel like they're getting all the benefits.
Without the
Yes.
I've been finding in my practice identifying the chattering and seeing those thoughts that go by, and how easy it is to get in there while meditating, and so coming back to the breath. But also what I notice is when I move my awareness around different parts of the body and the breath, a picture of that area comes up, and I'm not purposely visualizing it. It's just, you know, I think about the breath or just the abdomen, and that area I would have a picture of that. And it's more subtle. And seems to, but just from what you were talking about, I'm not sure if that picture is a barrier between me and the experience. So.
Some people will think more in images than in words. And so having images come up is, some people, fairly common. For some people, it happens sometimes. It's a kind of thought. And so it's a kind of an aboutness. It's kind of a little bit of separation. It's a construction of, we have the direct experience, and we construct something based on it. Like you can feel the sensation, you can close your eyes and feel the sensations of your hand. And you can also take those sensations and construct an image of that hand. You can make a fist and feel how that, the sensations of that, and make a different image of the fist. But the image is a construction that we add to it. So it does keep, if we primarily relate to the image, we're also somewhat removed from the direct experience. So it's very important for people who have images a lot in their meditation, not to push them away, but not to get involved with them, just kind of like, in a sense, let go of them or leave them in the background and bring the attention more fully into the actual experience.
So that makes me wonder, if that's not there, then there's just the feeling, the sensation. And even feeling and sensation is a kind of thought. Right now, that's what it appears to me. Without, when that picture goes, I'm not sure what's left.
That's your job to find out. That'd be great. It's a worthwhile exploration.
Yes. I would imagine that's how people feel when they're so dependent upon their minds. What would life be like without the mind?
Yeah, it can be very frightening, very disorienting at first. And it turns out to be wonderful. You have access. You know, the body is not just a lump of flesh we kind of, you know, useful for moving, carrying this computer around. It's filled with, it's kind of like an antenna. It picks up our reaction, it picks up our environment and other people, it senses them, it senses what's going on inside of us, our feelings, our emotion. And as it processes all the inner and outer life, as kind of like, this wisdom and understanding can kind of bubble up from the body also. And you have you have access to a lot more information and wisdom about what's going on in the world if you have a kind of whole sense of being present and sensing it all, as opposed to just kind of receiving it up here and living in the abstractions. So last one, then we'll sit again.
It just seems to me that that wisdom, you can look at it in other ways, like conscious, subconscious. We tend to spend all our time subconscious and we miss the wisdom in our conscious and miss the wisdom of the subconscious. Or all our time in our left brain and miss the wisdom of the right brain. Mindfulness seems to help me follow that.
Yeah, definitely. As the practice gets deeper, the barrier between the subconscious and the conscious kind of begins to dissolve to some degree. But for most people, the idea of conscious, subconscious still kind of, in the West especially, means up here. And there's a lot of value to, you know, the body consciousness, which is kind of a different thing in itself. So let's sit again. And then we're going to start by doing a little exercise. Close your eyes. And then think about some self-image of your body, a body image of yourself that's been a source of suffering. Some thoughts you've had about your body. that your body, some body part is too big, too small, too long, too short. Your forehead is too high, too low. Your hair is too this, too that. Not enough of it, not there. Your ears, your eyes, your nose, your mouth, whatever. Your thighs, your butt. Whatever part of your body that you've had some relationship to and you thought your body image, you had thoughts and ideas and that's caused you suffering. Remember the thoughts, the ideas you had about it? The discomfort you had about it? That image of yourself, that preoccupation. And then take a deep breath and let go of that. Empty your mind. And then let yourself feel the body's experience of itself when there's no ideas getting in the way. The immediate felt sense experience of the body feeling itself. And perhaps you felt a world of difference between those two ways of experiencing the body. So as we continue, just feel the body's experience of itself. Let go of yourself into your body and let whatever sensations in the body arise, let them arise in whatever way they want, as if it's completely a random display of sensations in your body. Let them just come and go as they wish. Letting the free flow of sensation slowly awaken the various parts of your body where you're not very conscious of. And then within the body, as part of the body experience, become aware of your breathing. Notice how the sensations of breathing are changing as you breathe. And let yourself rest in the changing nature of those sensations. Hanging out with the changing sensations of breathing through time. If some strong sensation in the body or some sound comes into the foreground of attention, let go of the breath and let the meditative awareness receive that. If it just goes away or no longer feels compelling, then you can return again to your breathing. So then, as you do your daily meditation for the next week, you can expand what you do beyond the breath to include your sensations, your physical body, as it seems appropriate to include it as part of the what you pay attention to. And the other thing that you might do, I'll give you two homework assignments outside of meditation that might be very interesting to explore. One is, you know, the bumper sticker that says, like, I stop for animals or I break for animals. For the next week, your bumper sticker can be, I stop for tension. I break for tension. Various times during the day for the next week, stop in the middle of your daily life. You know, maybe you're kind of waiting for a red light in the car, or you have some idle moments waiting for something, or just find some reasons to kind of stop in the middle of your day. And notice if there's any tension in your body. And if there's any tension in your body, bring this kind of meditative awareness to it. Don't try to get rid of it or make it go away. Just bring your attention to it and hold it in your awareness. Explore it, be present for it. Try to avoid living in the aboutness about it. Just to be with it directly for a minute, 2 minutes, and see how that changes the situation you're in. Just to do that, just to acknowledge the tension that's there and to be with it a little bit. And you might find that it makes a big difference for your daily life. So you can get a little bumper sticker that says, I break for tension. The other homework assignment is to start noticing the difference between what you're experiencing and the relationship you create to what you're experiencing. Because they're two very different worlds. And part of the power of mindfulness, as I said earlier, arises when you can differentiate between what the experiences of the moment and your interpretations, your attitude, your relationship, your reaction to that experience. And as we know, it's possible to have one reaction, one relationship, and then 10 minutes later, kind of see it in a slightly different direction or whatever. And we have then a whole totally different relationship to it and reaction to it. A relationship that's actually quite fluid. And it's possible also to have no relationship, just to let it be there in the spaciousness of awareness. But make it a little bit of an assignment to kind of just very kind of non-judgmentally start noticing the difference between your relationship you form to the experience and the actual experience itself. That was clear enough? Great. So thank you, and I hope you have a wonderful week. And if anything seems not so clear or confusing, you're welcome to stay behind and ask.